As one of the most radically innovative authors of our time, in many ways, Cormac McCarthy extends the modernist pattern of experimentation to its logical conclusion, as David has noted discussed at length. But like T.S. Eliot, he claims with forthright honesty that a thoughtful use of influence is central to any genuine transformation of literary tradition. Essential to this aesthetic is a respect, even reverence, for the primacy of story, the revolutionary power of language, and the active participation of the audience as witness. Through a creative alchemy unprecedented today, McCarthy's works claim tradition, language, and narrative as a mode of literary empowerment. All these elements are integrated in the singular consciousness of the artist and reader, which in its beauty and embodied reality stands against the cosmological void McCarthy so frequently explores. In his Western works, the evocation of the border serves a multiple purpose. First, and most clearly, they are an exploration of America's frontier past. But also, and most presciently, they constitute a borderland between the material and the transcendent, the subjective and the objective in human perception, the perceivable and the mysterious, the known reality of the world, and the ghost reality of the world in its making. In considering McCarthy's use of influence as well as the intertextual patterns in his work, it has now become standard to refer to the 1992 interview with Richard B. Woodward in the New York Times Magazine entitled McCarthy's Venomous Fiction. In his encapsulation of a conversation with our author, Woodward quotes McCarthy, and we've heard this quote many times before, "The ugly fact is that books are made out of other books. The novel depends for its life on the novels that have been written." McCarthy cites a few writers, particularly Melville and Dostoevsky. Without question, Blood Meridian depends for its life on Moby Dick, and many of McCarthy's other novels, specifically the play The Sunset Limited, is an innovative recreation of the Brothers Karamazov. But there are a host of allusions throughout his novels and plays, large leitmotifs, overarching structural metaphors, and individual references that enrich his works, forming an important part of what makes them beautiful, McCarthy's own singular creative genius, what makes them sublime. Homer, Dante, the Bible, the Gnostic Gospels, the works of Milton and Shakespeare are only a few of the many, and they are so numerous that even if readers miss some, they will comprehend others. T.S. Eliot based his creative life on the idea that the great poet is endowed with historical sense and writes with the spirit of the past in his bones, thus creating literary art that is simultaneously traditional and innovative. McCarthy's aesthetic seems to comport well with this idea, but McCarthy seems to be about something else, something more mystically generative, less firmly classicist, embracing rather than rejecting romantic concepts of sublimity and depending on the mind of the reader to participate in the act of creation. He is by no means a relativist, nor do his works lend themselves to acts of wholesale reconceptualization on the part of the audience. They are too pressing, too informed, too full of substance and moral urgency to fall prey to reader response. But there is one word that is perhaps unavoidable when considering the relationship of author and reader as they come together in McCarthy's canon. That word is empathy. It may seem strange to suggest that intimate identification is a primary purpose in novels that court situations so foreign, so alien to our daily experience, often so horrific and violent. But to echo Child of God, each of his characters appear to us as children of God, much like ourselves. From John Wesley Ratner in The Orchard Keeper to Lester Ballard to Cullahome in Outer Dark, onward to the unnamed kid in Blood Meridian, and to the sympathetic heroes of the Border Trilogy, we are meant to identify in intimate ways with the characters and their struggles, striving to understand them even as we strive to understand ourselves. A few of us in McCarthy's studies had the opportunity to read The Road a month or so before its release, which led to a noticeable inertia in our responses to the novel at conferences such as this. At one of these meetings, Jay Ellis recounted a personal experience that mirrored my own. In 2006, which was the year The Road was released, my own son was 10 years old and my daughter 13. I didn't imagine myself the man in The Road, at least not in terms of his courage and fortitude, or even the force of his character. But even on the first read, my eyes rested mesmerized on these now familiar words. He knew only that the child was his warrant, he said, if he is not the word of God, God never spoke. Later in the novel, after the man has used one of his bullets to kill a cannibal, the father admonishes the boy, like all of us might, in a moment of threat. My job is to take care of you. I was appointed to do that by God. I will kill anyone who touches you. Do you understand? In situations such as these, which occur in McCarthy's novels from the beginning, we're drawn to empathy, a deep, even intimate sense of identification, and we are confronted with the singular fact that grounds the study of phenomenology, that human consciousness is perhaps the most unique, beautiful, compelling, and mysterious thing the universe has created. For all of his philosophical portentousness and the apparent objectivity of his narration, McCarthy is first and primarily an artist of the personal. His novels are an externalization of consciousness. His character is deeply human. Insofar as he shares this with the greatest works of literature, with Shakespeare, Milton, Melville, Dostoevsky, his works are not derivative, but participatory, not only in the realm of objective experience, but in the subjective realm of the human mind itself. In McCarthy's view, consciousness, in Whitmanesque terms, casts silken threads of acute awareness outward into the air, inviting this interconnection of minds, and it does this by asserting the primacy of narrative, the human story perpetually told. We experience this idea throughout McCarthy's novels, in their dialectical structure, in the intricate blend of narration, description, dialogue, and extended monologue. But the idea that as humans we live within narrative, circumscribed and empowered by language, bound together by the act of telling and the role of the witness, is most clearly thematized in The Crossing. Ostensibly an adventure story with a picaresque structure, this second novel in the Border Trilogy proves to be, in a different way than The Road, McCarthy's confession, revealing directly, for the first time perhaps, what motivated his many sacrifices as an author. To live is to speak. To find meaning is both to hear and speak again. In Three Crossings Over Geographical and Spiritual Borders, the main character, Billy Parham, comes of age through a series of confrontations with incarnate evil and a set of encounters with people who have been tempered by experience. They stand ready to tell him their stories, and from them, he gains a provisional wisdom as he comes to apprehend, at least vaguely, that he is a player in a universal drama, a single story written by a silent author who pens the trajectory of single lives with sublime vision and insight beyond human comprehension. In his border experiences, Billy listens to the priest and his tale of the pensioner, to the blind revolutionary and his wife, and to the gitano, the gypsy in charge of the wrecked airplane. All of them present stories that emerge as reinscriptions of a single narrative of human fate and destiny. They contain and order all in a sweeping story that lends form and purpose to what remains the mystery of human experience and the mystery of suffering that at times brings us to our knees. This idea is most directly told by the priest. McCarthy writes, and I will butcher these place names, what does Caborca know of Huizachapec? Huizachapec of Caborca. They are different worlds, you must agree. Yet even so, there is but one world, and everything that is imaginable is necessary to it. For this world also, which seems to us a thing of stone and flower and blood, is not a thing at all, but is a tale. And all in it is a tale, and each tale the sum of all lesser tales, and yet these are also the selfsame tale, and contain as well all else within them. So everything is necessary, every last thing. This is the hard lesson. Nothing can be dispensed with, nothing despised, because the seams are hid from us, you see, the joinery, the way in which the world is made. We have no way to know what could be taken away, what omitted. We have no way to tell what might stand and what might fall. And those seams that are hid from us are the course of the tale itself, and the tale has no abode or place of being except in the telling only, and there it lives and makes its home, and therefore we can never be done with the telling. Of the telling, there is no end. and whether in Caborca or Huizachapec or in whatever other place by whatever other name or by no name at all, I say again, all tales are one. Rightly heard, all tales are one. Central to the priest's synthesis of his own story is a series of relationships between the experience and the teller and his own conscious awareness and response, the tale and the witness, the witness and Billy, the silent interlocutor. Binding them all is the shared moment of hearing and the empathy that emerges as the tale is recognized and relived, both in the moment of telling and in perpetual memory. Human experience in its richest and most meaningful form takes place in the realm of the phenomenological through hearing and apprehending, again in Whitmanesque terms, through peering, absorbing, translating. The tragic, even horrific travails of the priest, the revolutionary, and the Gitano find no genuine compensation in the telling. But their stories rearticulated are nevertheless received, taken into the singular consciousness of the witness, and retold, ultimately, in the novel itself. We are given clearly to understand that truth value in The Crossing has nothing to do with the fictiveness of the story. For McCarthy, the divide between fiction and nonfiction is a false distinction. The epistemological relevance of the novel form does not derive from fictional events that carry a thematic import. Excuse me. It derives from the universal, even transcendent legitimacy of the fiction itself, which is grounded not in a single set of historical events, but in the universal story that binds human bodies and human minds to the world in all its mystery. McCarthy makes more than a romantic gesture here, and the linkage of The Crossing to Hegelian dialectics is reasonably well established. In a move reminiscent of Emerson, Thoreau, and Whitman, he seeks to bind all into the irreducibly complex but orderly weave of the world. In this tapestry, we see the role of influence and the manner in which his literary forebears empower his works. Again, in The Crossing, McCarthy writes, "Who can dream of God, seated solely in the light of his own presence, weaving the world? A God with a fathomless capacity to bend all to an inscrutable purpose, not chaos lay outside of that matrix, and somewhere in that tapestry was the world in its making, and in its unmaking was a thread that was he, and he awoke weeping." The world in its making, the thread that was he, the tapestry, and the matrix, all integrated physically in an inconceivable process that is nevertheless purposeful. The image of the weaver god is drawn directly from the Bower of the Arsacides chapter in Moby Dick. In that book, Melville's world is made metonymic in the vast, immemorial, and unremembering sea, where move endless processions of the whale and one grand hooded phantom like a snow hill in the air. Lurking there also is the world in its making where, like McCarthy's world, are all the horrors of the half-known life. Melville writes, "The weaver god he weaves, and by that weaving is he deafened, that he hears no mortal voice, and by that humming we too who look on the loom are deafened, and only when we escape it shall we hear the thousand voices that speak through it." In Melville's concept, God himself is deafened by the action of his own creative process. McCarthy imbues The Crossing with the same foreboding and a deeper recognition of the reality of violence. But he takes power from the original reference and reorganizes its meaning, rearticulating it in such a way that the weaver god cannot help but hear, being himself synonymous with the tale, its telling, and its perpetuation by the witness. In a more subtle but nevertheless substantial way, the creative relationship of story to human identity precedes the border crossing, notably in McCarthy's masterpiece, Blood Meridian. This novel entered the scene with little fanfare, with scant attention from critics, and a limited readership. In many ways, this was odd, given that McCarthy had so recently won the coveted MacArthur Fellowship. But the staggering portrayal of violence and the portentous philosophy of destruction expressed by the judge certainly consigned the novel to a specialized readership, despite the fact that it is now recognized as one of the cornerstones of world literary art in the late 20th century. As we know, Blood Meridian is a frontier narrative, a metaphysical and epistemological romance, and a book that transcends genre. And let me say that when I teach Moby Dick, I often speak of it as a book. It cannot be classified as a novel, really. There's a novel in it, but it contains so much else. And I think that we can start to talk about Blood Meridian in some ways in the same way, a book that transcends genre. But it is essentially a dark picaresque that in its chapter captioning evokes the explorer narratives of the late 19th century. It tells the story of an unnamed kid who journeys west and becomes involved first with an ill-fated army troop and then with an infamous gang of scalp hunters led by John Joel Glanton. The story takes its basis, as we know, from an actual history written by Samuel Chamberlain, Recollections of a Rogue, which is the only source in which the horrific and ultimately compelling Judge Holden can be found. Again, the chapter captioning immediately calls attention to the events as narrative, even as we come to know that they are founded in an actual history. The fact that events and people are drawn from a written recollection suggests that the circumstances recounted are simultaneously real, recollected, and in the end, storied, forming inevitably the narrative weave of the world. McCarthy is supremely conscious of the interrelationship of truth and the web of telling that forms the epistemological logic of this and other novels, beginning with a poetic, lyrical, almost fable-like tone and style. And this is the first paragraph of the novel, or piece of the first paragraph. See the child. He is pale and thin. He wears a thin and ragged linen shirt. He stokes the scullery fire. Outside lie dark-turned fields with rags of snow and darker woods beyond that harbor yet a few last wolves. His folk are known for hewers of wood and drawers of water, but in truth, his father was a schoolmaster. He lies in drink. He quotes from poets whose names are now lost. The boy crouches by the fire and watches him. All history present in that visage, the child, the father of the man. Foregrounded in the direct address to the reader is the act of telling and the invitation to the witness. See the child draws the reader into the narrative and in no way sacrifices the distanced, storied, and folkloric quality of a series of events that are rooted in only a half-known history. The borderland here embodies what Mary Louise Pratt refers to as a contact zone, and I should stop and say that I first encountered Pratt in Nick Monk's essay that he wrote for the Cambridge Companion. So although I haven't footnoted that, that's really where that is drawn, and he deals with that extensively, this idea of the contact zone. The contact zone, which is a porous boundary, in this case an embodied space that eradicates the distinction between fiction and history, that blends and makes inextricable the relationship of truth and the narratives that give it structure. Drawn into this one narrative, the reader is yet again enfolded into a version of the one tale. But the content of Blood Meridian reminds us that the one story does not involve a simple through line, but a tapestry. And here, the threads are rough woven and dark, connoting that part of the weave involves violence, indiscriminate bloodletting, and a bleak justification for degradation in the extreme. The reader as witness becomes involved then in more than the story being told, but in the complex of influences and direct allusions that give it texture and bind it to the very tradition that makes it most innovative. The child, the father of the man, is taken from William Wordsworth's My Heart Leaps Up When I Behold. And the novel is imbued with the Jacobean language and cadences of the King James Bible, with Dante, Shakespeare, and the dialectical interchanges echoing Melville and Dostoevsky. Among many more developed allusions, the judge and the niter scene is drawn from Milton's Paradise Lost, and Judge Holden, 7 feet tall, bald, cold white, and ubiquitous, is a clear reconfiguration of the great white whale, the grand hooded phantom of Moby Dick. In her talk in the Yale lecture series, Amy Hungerford sees the judge as an allusion to Captain Ahab. Hungerford is excellent with a host of references and is certainly correct in emphasizing the importance of Melville's masterpiece. But the judge is reconceptualized from not Ahab, but the white whale himself, or itself. Ahab is too monomaniacal, too human, to obsessed, and in the end, it is the very transformation of Ahab into a satanic figure that divorces him from the judge as reference. To call the judge evil is a massive oversimplification. Like the white whale, he suggests a universal force of destruction that no mythic concept of evil can contain. It is right to say that the judge may be what is behind the pasteboard mask, the mystery of human plight that Ahab hopes to strike through in killing Moby Dick. Destruction, malevolence, and brutality define him, but so do they provide the dark texture that adds a portentous meaning to the one tale rightfully told. In a powerful moment in the novel, when the judge addresses the band, he demonstrates the innate process whereby even scientific facts become threads in the elaborate tapestry. Quote, "In the end, he sat in the compound breaking ore samples with a hammer, a feldspar rich in white oxide of copper and native nuggets in whose organic lobations he purported to read news of the Earth's origins, holding an extemporary lecture in geology to a small gathering who nodded and spat. A few would quote him scripture to confound his ordering up of eons out of the ancient chaos and other apostate supposings. The judge smiled. Books lie, he said. God don't lie, another character says. No, said the judge, he does not, and these are his words. He held up a chunk of rock. He speaks in stones and trees, the bones of things. The judge continues later, speaking to them in the old epic mode, and it becomes clear that nothing lies external to language. Not that in the Derridean sense words are arbitrary signifiers, but as Emerson argues, the earth itself is logos, language itself an emanation of an absolute reality, however mysterious and frightening. In a novel that presents itself as a picaresque fable and a history together, for the judge and his witnesses, all books are lies unless they speak the universal tale of wandering and woe, of destruction and violent regeneration. In The Road, McCarthy continues and heightens this theme, though he softens it significantly. Ironically, he does so with a peculiar aesthetic sleight of hand. The idea of the world as tale is retained, but the road is terse and seemingly unadorned, sparse and tactile, as if the world has been stripped of illusions and reduced to its darkest essentials. But even the minimalist language is drawn from tradition, and while displaying his own voice, McCarthy echoes the style of Ernest Hemingway, even using playful allusions to Hemingway's short stories, Indian Camp and Cat in the Rain. But the novel, pun very much intended, is a road narrative containing many of the same features as any adventure tale. A journey, a spiritual quest, a post-apocalyptic character-driven story full of conflict and striving. McCarthy conceptualized The Road in this manner from the beginning. In the McCarthy papers and manuscripts held in the Whitliff collections at Texas State University San Marcos, we've discovered that the working title of the novel was The Grail. And in excised passages, the boy is much more clearly a messianic figure. Thus, The Road is built out of the sum of the oldest stories, the Christian Gospels and the Arthurian legends. But the story elements are not merely structural features employed formally to construct an externalized tale. In The Road, they are linked to the deepest recesses of human consciousness, to dreams. McCarthy writes, "In his dream, she was sick and he cared for her. The dream bore the look of sacrifice, but he thought differently. He did not care. He did not take care of her, and she died alone somewhere in the dark, and there is no other dream, nor other waking world, and there is no other tale to tell." In dreaming of his departed wife, the past becomes present and inescapable. Dream, thought, and memory are all one, forming the substance even of the waking world and taking shape through narrative, again in the one tale first fully conceived in The Crossing. Dreams themselves, though an aspect of human consciousness, are never removed from the oldest and most resilient form of narrative construction, sacrifice, which in the course of history is central to ritual, romance, theater, and the binding tapestry of story structures that seem, for McCarthy, to form the essence of human perception. Quote, The dream bore the look of sacrifice, but he thought differently, unquote. As the man is forced for one torturous moment to think outside the dream, he is confronted with darkness, the inexpressible loneliness of a godless death, and a cosmological void bereft of meaning. The road is at times a composite of frightening internal monologues that frequently contradict one another, standing in tense dialectical relation. And this monologue expresses the horror of the world outside the dream and external to the one tale rightfully told. The novel refers to these dreams repeatedly, sometimes in a positive and sometimes a negative sense. At one point, the man even ponders the idea that dreams of death suggest the presence of the survival impulse. At other times, however, dreams perform a more generative function, as the man ponders their contours. Quote, "And dreams so rich in color, how else would death call you? Waking in the cold dawn, it all turned to ash instantly, like certain ancient frescoes entombed for centuries suddenly exposed to the day." As we consider the figurative meaning of the universe as cosmological void, though it later takes on a more rich association with the typological wilderness of the Bible, the only defense from oblivion is dreams rich in color that must be protected like ancient works of art that are the visual embodiment of narratives, myths, and ancient histories. The one tale to tell then emerges from the deepest recesses of consciousness, and the basic phenomenological fact is that the mind, the dream, the story, the ritual, the frescoes entombed are the bound substance of human experience and of the highly determined matter of which we are comprised, as they spin through space-time, bending, to echo the stonemason, the very warp of the world. In the end, The Road may be the reinscription of many works within the Western literary tradition, but in many ways it is most obviously a synthesis of the Bible, which is not one work but many. It may not be an overstatement. Well, it is an overstatement, but I'll say it anyway. It's a little rhetorical flourish here. It may not be an overstatement to say that The Road is, if The Road were the one book found after the great cataclysm, it might be the new Genesis or the first gospel. It places two people into a typological wilderness under the most trying of circumstances, confronts them with the grandest question, that of the existence, purpose, and nature of the divine. Job-like, it confronts the question of suffering and redemption. And similar to the Gospel of John, it seeks to define the interrelationship of physical matter and spiritual reality. As a novel containing an existential Christian subtext, the boy cannot pray to God, but only to the Father who has loved him. And the believing woman responds with understanding. And I quote, "The woman said that was all right. She said that the breath of God was his breath yet, though it passed from man to man through all of time." These are all quotes that we're familiar with. With a revealing and perhaps coincidental similarity to Ingmar Bergman's Through a Glass Darkly, God quite simply is love. And to pray is to pray to the Father who, perhaps unknown to himself, was the divine, fully realized for the boy. Thus, the sacred nature of this text, drawn with explicit references to other religious works, is inextricably bound to tradition, narrative, story, and the one tale carried forward. Thus, the role of influence has a distinctive meaning in McCarthy's works. It can reasonably be said that any allusion in any work of literature, whether a sweeping structural metaphor or a brief line reference, empowers by bringing the whole of the previous work into the body of the new. All of the themes, meanings, subtle associations, the totality of the reader's memory of the original novel, poem, or play imbue the new work with intensity and significance through the memory of the reader. In constituting his own aesthetic and implementing it throughout his work, McCarthy is acutely aware of this mode of literary empowerment. But unlike other writers, the body of his novels suggests that writing and art are more essential than we might have supposed, that the grand and ordered architecture of the world itself can never be made separate from its expression in narrative. Stories told and retold, the world in its making, the threads that are each of us, are made real through the act of expression and witness. And from this living dream, we must all wake weeping. but the grief that inspires those tears is tempered with the deepest empathy, a half-known apprehension of our connection to each other as we fashion threads in the weave of the larger tapestry of the world. Thank you.